Good morning and welcome back to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We also want to acknowledge our producers, the people that really make this program possible, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. Well, in this part of the show, we're going to have the first in what we're planning to do as a series over the coming weeks of a number of programs trying to look at international issues that figure in this year's presidential race here in the United States. Things that perhaps don't get as much attention as they should, or perhaps now because of our preoccupation with domestic economic issues, maybe just won't get the attention that they should. And in the first program here, we'll be talking a little bit about the world food crisis. And what I'm suggesting is that people remember not all that long ago the kinds of things that we were talking about earlier this spring, where people, various places around the world, were coping with some serious spikes in food prices. In some places, this actually caused riots, caused unrest. And in this country, I imagine it also caused some discomfort as people were going down to the grocery store and trying to buy food for their families. And there was a lot of debate and discussion about what caused this. And different people, maybe they had different answers to that question, made complicated by the fact that, well, it is complicated. It's probably not just one thing. It's probably a number of things. Well, this morning we're going to revisit this subject and talk a little bit about perhaps what if anything, government policy has to do with the issue of food prices. And we have two guests with us here in the studio. Gail Summerfield is Associate Professor of Human and Community Development here at the University of Illinois. She's also Director of Women and Gender in Global Perspectives Program. Also here in the studio is Mary Ahrens Kenning. She is affiliated with the Center for Latin American and Caribbean Studies, the Center for South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies, and also this same program, that is the Women and Gender and Global Perspectives program. And we're pleased that the two of them could be here, spend some time talking with us. Questions are certainly welcome, as always, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We should invite folks in there and say, you know, we'd be very happy to have you participate in the conversation. The only thing we ask of people is just if they could try to be brief so we can get in as many as possible. But certainly, they're welcome. Maybe I also should mention that Professor Ahrens Kenning is also associate professor in ACES, College of Agricultural and Consumer Economics. I got that right?
It's the Department of Agricultural and Consumer Economics.
All right, good. We like long titles here at this university, so I like to try to see if I get all that straight. Well, thanks very much for being here. I feel that, maybe it's in something of the nature of media that we go from one thing to another, and that we probably do need to remind people that it was not all that long ago that this was one of the top issues that we were talking about. And it was not just an issue here in the United States. It was an international issue that we suddenly had some really serious issues with price and supply of commodities and food. And people were saying, well, what's going on here? First of all, this issue hasn't gone away. We're talking about other stuff, but this is still an issue. And the things that went into making it happen, nothing really has changed, right?
There's been a little change, but it is still an issue. People are not out in the streets demonstrating right now because the immediate crisis of so many people being driven into poverty has been slightly alleviated. But the UN has taken some action to bring different units together, and they're still actively working on addressing the factors that are contributing to this ongoing global food crisis. And I think that there's a cyclical aspect, so we may see things again in the spring if we haven't addressed them adequately. Mm-hmm. And the World Food Program doesn't have enough money yet for this year, and it's just one of several organizations internationally that are trying to address these different problems. Do you want me to mention some things? I think we ought to think a little bit about the different causes. Yeah. One thing that happened was that suddenly we saw people out in the street demonstrating. It wasn't really a lack of food. It wasn't a supply-side crisis that we saw. And it shows us that distributional issues are particularly important in people's well-being and ability to have full participation in society. So some of the causes are general, like demand is growing, population continues to grow. China and India, in particular, are beginning to have their people eat better, higher up the food chain, so that they're getting more milk and more meat and things like that that also are based on having more grains for feed. But this didn't just shoot up overnight. This is an ongoing issue. It's not a problem. It's actually something we should be happy to see, that people are getting healthier kind of diets. But it will be something we continue to need to address. And it contributed somewhat to price increases, but as I said, not to shooting up. One of the things that did shoot up was the price of oil and the energy. That directly affects agricultural production in a variety of ways, like in terms of fertilizer in particular and agricultural machinery, but especially transportation to market. And then indirectly, it has promoted over the last few years our look at alternative energies more, among other ways of going. And the biofuels program of the United States and the EU have been thought to be certainly one of the big contributors to what was happening at that time because of the subsidies and taking grains for other uses. And at least they made people step back and say, let's reevaluate a little bit. Obama, for instance, has said that he wants to reevaluate their biofuels subsidy program based on what happened. There's also certainly droughts, running down of food reserves, and exacerbation through speculation. But those were, I think, some of the biggest issues.
Mm-hmm. I think that this is an interesting case study of how complicated a particular problem can be, and about how it is that various factors can come along over a period of time, and one factor can lay on top of another, so that suddenly you get to the point where you've got a tipping point and you see a dramatic result. And so people are saying, why did this happen, as if this was something that had just happened overnight or the result of recent developments? And I think that you have to look at that and say, well, no, this has been coming for a while. We see some trends that develop over maybe at least a couple of years, and that I'm sure people who are tracking these various things were paying attention. But it was when it all seemed to come together, that's when we had this critical issue. We saw very high prices for some basic commodities, wheat and corn, and that the price of anything that had wheat and corn in it was going to go up because the price of the commodities were more. People were already concerned about the cost of energy, and that certainly was a factor on its own in contributing to this. So that you really have to appreciate the fact that you can't say I'll tell you what the thing is. There's one thing. No, it's not just one thing, and it's not something that just happened just yesterday.
And the experts can't agree on the share of the cause of each of these elements. Mm-hmm. They know these all contribute, but they debate over how much.
And here, certainly people in the United States, I'm sure many people felt a pinch because, as I said, you know, commodity prices went up. So that meant that price of food went up. And I'm sure people noticed it when they went to the store because bread was more expensive. And a lot of things have corn products in them, so that was more expensive. But I think that people need to appreciate, though, that if you look at outside of the United States, particularly in developing countries, that this was an even more critical kind of issue, and the kind of problems that people were facing were I'm sure worse than people here in Champaign-Urbana when they went down to the grocery store and bought bread.
Right. Well, for sure. I mean, I've noticed this too, and I can't remember being really aware of food prices going up since I was a little kid when I was growing up in the 70s. And so maybe we don't buy as much beef as we used to, or we don't buy steak. But it's important to realize that in developing countries, poor people are spending 50%, 70% of their income on food, and that percentage is going up. And that's one of the markers that we use to measure people's well-being, is what percentage of their income are they spending on food. So when that goes up, we see that people are worse off because there's less money for them to spend on other things. Mm-hmm. So this affects people in developing countries a lot more than it does people here.
Yeah. this is something that there are things here that are going to be cyclical. Whether you don't know what's going to happen with the weather, you don't know what's going to happen with the price of energy. There are a lot of things here that you really can't predict. You know they're going to go up there. You know they're going to go down. Back in the spring, I talked with somebody about this, and he made a point that I thought was significant. And he said, well, one thing that you should at least bear in mind is that for something like 100 years, the price of food actually was going down. Mm-hmm. And that for a long time, it was going in the other direction. And recently, we've seen this spike. Does anybody think, though, that this kind of upturn is some kind of trend that now is this a stable trend? Are we going to expect to be paying more in the future? And after this long period of time where food prices have declined, do we say, well, there were reasons for that, but now things have changed and that's over?
Yes, we think there's a shift. There was a meeting in Beijing in December. IFPRI, an organization in Washington, D.C., has been doing a lot of work on this. And Bob Thompson on campus, who I know you've interviewed. Mm-hmm. One reason there's a shift is there's this growing demand that is not going to go away. Oil prices are likely to continue going up. It's going to be a while before we really shift to alternative energy. I think we're very likely have seen a change that's going to be maintained and that we need to address. Another thing that's happening is that reserves are being used up because we haven't kept up with these changes. And if we don't replenish these, we're going to see a supply side shock as well as this demand kind of change that came in suddenly. So we need to do more work on agricultural research and development. And I think that we're going to see a lot of people suffer. We're already talking about 100 million extra people going into poverty because of this one-year kind of shift that hasn't been fully resolved, and that adds to 800 million worldwide. We have problems in the U.S., but we only consider about 37 million of our people living in poverty, and we haven't been able to eradicate that. It's certainly a goal to continue trying to alleviate that, but we do have programs that reach more of them. But worldwide, these 900 million now or more people who are in extreme poverty are really going potentially to suffer a whole lot more if we don't address this ongoing aspect of this crisis that can get much worse at times.
Mm-hmm. I think I have a little bit different take from Gail, because I have a little more faith in the price system and the response to the price system on the supply side. I think the issues there, I know for a fact that Africa is well below what it could produce if people could get fertilizer, if people could get credit to buy to buy fertilizer and better seeds and what they need to be productive. And so part of it is the price sends a strong signal to producers that they should produce more and that it would be profitable for them to do so. But we have to think about what might be impeding farmers in different countries from responding to that. And part of it could be environmental as well. There's certainly problems in Africa with soil degradation and lack of water. So it's a very, very complicated issue. But I think sometimes we need to remember, too, that there's a supply side here as well, and we need to help farmers to be able to respond to those price signals in the appropriate way. So there's also a difference between how rural people respond to this to urban people. So urban people who are food consumers, they are unambiguously hurt by this increase. But on the supply side, there's an opportunity there. That's one thing we can think about it, that this is an opportunity to really help farmers in developing countries to be more productive and to figure out why they're not able to respond to price signals.
Yeah, I have a couple of callers here. We'll get right to them. Maybe one further question. And it may be the kind of question you really have to have an agronomist to answer. But realistically, how much does anybody think productivity could be increased?
Well, they think there's a lot of potential for it. I'm not an agronomist, but I do think that they're looking at drought-resistant variety of crops. They're looking at new ways of utilizing water. They're looking at the issues of GMOs have come up again, all the different biotech kind of approaches, and a new green revolution is being talked about for Africa quite a bit. I would just like to insert, our perspective on looking at some of these issues, that they're not evenly distributed. either. And the gender aspects of differences for women and men and children are really important, too, because you get, as you look around the world in developing countries with a lot of poverty, you still have relatively more women that are counted in the poor, especially the households that don't have dual earners that are adults. And so they get very hard hit, and their needs are very high if they have other women in the households that are pregnant or in the early years of child raising. So those kind of interventions and looking for some kind of safety net that addresses differential needs for women and men are very important. There's also issues of if you have export crops, they suddenly become male-controlled in some areas and instead of going toward the needs of the households for women. So you don't have households that are always totally cooperative about how they use their budgets. And these kind of aspects have made a difference in the past in terms of the impact of financial and other kind of economic crises on the well-being of the people that are hit by them. And we've done a lot of analysis on that now. So the question is, can we begin to incorporate that into social safety nets so that crises like this, global food crisis and the current financial crisis in the U.S. is very likely to exacerbate this, so that we can take that into account as we look at ways that we might intervene and alleviate the suffering earlier and give opportunity for people to really benefit.
Oh, I'd like to add a little bit to what Gail just said about safety nets. Something people might not realize is the last 10 or 15 years, there's been a lot of advances in putting in safety nets, social safety nets in different developing countries. So, for example, in Mexico, they have a huge anti-poverty program now called Oportunidades. And it, the way it's designed, there's monitoring, there's data that are being collected, so it's easy to identify who's poor and who's suffering. So actually when tortilla prices went up last year, that program was able to respond very quickly to get more resources to poor families in Mexico. And I would like to make sure that we do what we can to ensure that these work well, these safety nets work well. One concern I have with the global crisis that's happening now is if credit dries up for governments or if governments of Mexico or of other developing countries have to dismantle those safety nets or they're not able to get funding to do that. Because I think sometimes people have an impression that development aid or that development isn't working or that nothing's being done about poverty. And I think people might not be aware the last 10 or 15 years there really has been quite a bit of very exciting things going on in development.
Let's talk with some callers here. We'll go first to the first person in line, and that's someone in Urbana in line one. Hello. Yes.
It seems that there's a lot of ways that food aid has gone downhill. Both in Haiti and Mexico, the corn production in Mexico has gone down because of world trade policies and U.S. Grain companies taking over in there. And then in Haiti, I mean, Haiti used to have exports, and now basically they're dependent on aid. So by giving them aid instead of even increasing, helping them with production, even back to 1980 standards, has seriously deteriorated things.
Well, here's the caller raises several, I think, good points. Maybe let me just direct you in one way and say, well, first, why don't we just talk about direct food aid, what the United States is doing, how much money we spend on that, and whether that's a good way to address the problem that we're talking about. If we're talking about the problem of access to food in developing countries, is direct food aid a good way of trying to get at it?
We have a pretty low percentage of our income that we put toward development aid in general, including food aid. But we have a high income in the United States. So we do contribute a lot to programs like the World Food Programs and others. I think one point that I would like to make, since it's brought up in terms of connecting it back to the presidential candidates, is McCain is obviously much less interventionist in his approach than Obama. Neither one of them have really talked about the global food crisis at this point. They were talking about it a bit when people were out in the streets in April and earlier in the spring, but now it's kind of gone down from the agenda. And one of the goals of many of us working in this area is to get this back on their agenda. I think it we'll see a need when people do also go out in the streets again. But before that, anticipating that crises will get worse for a variety of reasons, that we can prepare and address it sooner. So part of the food aid package that needs to go in is that we need to be able to buy food locally. And that has been a shift from the past, so that we're not going in and destroying local markets and local farmers, but we're trying to actually build them up so that they can sustain their areas during these crises. The Obama campaign last night in the vice presidential debate, Biden said when asked what they might have to cut back because of the financial crisis, mentioned only one item, and that was the overseas development aid, that they had planned to increase it by 50%, and that looks like it's going to have to be cut.
And that isn't that really a very, very small percent of the of the budget that we're really not talking. We're talking about, I don't know, 1%, 2%, something like that. So cutting, you know, in the overall scheme of things, in just in terms of saving money, cutting that is not going to get us very far.
Right.
That's true. And well, to get back to the caller mentioned something about farmers in Mexico and facing not being able to compete. I think that gets back to what I was saying before, that with these high prices, that might be an opportunity for Mexican corn farmers. But the issue is, are they going to be able to take advantage of those increases in prices? And those are deal with issues, very local development issues like roads, access to credit, access to technology and seed that's suited for where they're growing, all these types of issues. So I would agree with the caller in so far as that point.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Champaign County. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi. Well, that sounded extremely disingenuous or uninformed. I hate to be confrontational. It's such a male image. But you haven't mentioned something, a word that's known around the world that Americans are relatively ignorant of, and it's the expression is neoliberalism, and it describes the World Bank and IMF policies that advocated for Haiti, you know, to be a light industry. So the women who should be getting farm credit to raise food for their starving children, emaciated children, and are instead obliged to work in these light industry, which then can be moved to somewhere else very quickly and have been at the discretion of whatever industrialists and whatever policy is regnant. I mean, Haiti is, well, that and Mexico. You didn't mention that, you mentioned about the increase in price, but what about the subsidies? I mean, we're dumping corn. It was known what would happen. Maquiladoras, where the young women, Mexican women, mainly slave, you know, are, it's a good job, they say, but that's only because there isn't any really development plan. So I'm sorry, I couldn't restrain myself from being the Cassandra in the room here.
Well, I think the issue of farm subsidies, I would agree basically with what you were saying, that they have lowered food prices around the world, and we were hearing a lot about that a year or two ago. But now food prices are high.
Well, I'm sorry. The point I was making that they lower food prices, they actually are high priced if you count in the subsidy. And the what they've done is they've devastated the rural countryside in so many countries around the world. And it was a strategy. They thought they needed light industry, hands for the electronic assembly or whatever.
Well, I think we are agreeing. We're saying that we do need to invest more in agriculture, and agriculture plays an important role in development. And I think, you know, the effect of U.S. subsidies is to lower prices on the world market, and that is causing local producers in developing countries, that's a disincentive to produce. So I agree with you in that sense. That's the way that works out. I don't think we disagree with you that agriculture shouldn't be neglected in development. And I agree with you that perhaps the World Bank or other institutions, they really did neglect agriculture for a while, for a long time.
Well,
and now we're seeing
the
results of that.
Again. They didn't neglect it. They devastated it. Structural adjustment. They made it impossible for impoverished nations to extend farm credit because of the strictures of their budgetary requirements. They were making countries charge education fees in Africa, where, you know, it eliminated mostly young girls, but many in the countryside from going to. I mean, you sound like that you believe the free market is working, and this is just an aberration, this subsidy of. It's not. It hasn't existed for quite a few years. This is was a calculated strategy, and it's a war. It's a crime against humanity, is what it is.
I'd like to speak something to what you're saying. The issue of neoliberal policies isn't new, and we won't all agree on all of these issues. But I know I've been working for many years on looking at economic restructuring impacts on women and men, looking at, and this is basically what's economic restructuring, as you briefly mentioned, that is the neoliberal policy set. We also sometimes call it neoclassical. We call it transition policies in some countries, structural adjustment programs, lots of different names, but they come back to sets of very similar policies. However, when you start talking about the details of a particular country, they play out rather differently, so that what is happening in Haiti may be quite different from what's happening in China or Indonesia or Egypt. And so we really have to look at regionally and country-specific groups of policies and how they're playing out. Mm-hmm. And I do think that there was a lack, especially in the – a lack of attention in the 70s and 80s to many of these social issues. And there's been a lot of calls from researchers, from people working in various movements around the world, and from NGOs to address those. And there's been, I think, to some extent, a shift in looking at that. That's not to say that the IMF and the World Bank are off the hook. They are not. We still need to consider that. But there is now social safety net lending from the World Bank, which was an improvement in that aspect, and often was able, like in the Asia crisis in Indonesia, to keep girls and boys in school who may have been pulled out for a short-term crisis and therefore had their whole lives affected. And when you can keep them in school through some scholarships during the crisis, then you give them a chance.
Hmm. Well, I guess I expect that there are some people at least who would agree with what the caller said and would say make something like an argument, something like a combination of American egg policy in regards to American farmers, coupled with international economic policy that was intended to help developing countries, that whether either that was just bad policy, unintentional bad policy or intentional bad policy, the result has been really bad for developing countries and for small farmers in developing countries. Do you think that – I mean, setting aside whether that was the intent – do you think that that actually was their result, and that it has been the result of planning on the level of these large international economic institutions and the kind of policies that here in this country we've put in place to help American farmers?
Well, who wants to handle that one? I would make a distinction between saying neoliberalism and the international price system. I don't think – I mean, of course, one affects the other, but – saying people respond to price increases or decreases is not the same thing as saying I support neoliberal policies. I think it's important to realize that within the world of development economists, that even I've been at conferences with World Bank and IMF people who have discredited this and said, you know, we really made mistakes there. This doesn't – we thought if you got prices right, if you got the macro economy right – these countries would grow, and they realize that they're wrong. And I think people at the World Bank all recognize now, and unfortunately, maybe people have been harmed by these policies. They have that paying, you know, making families pay to go to school was a bad policy. And in fact, if you look around the world now, the World Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, all these institutions are loaning money to countries to pay children to go to school. These are very well-known programs around the world. Bolsa Familia in Brazil, Oportunidades in Mexico, Food for Education in Bangladesh. All of these programs had strong World Bank World Bank support, and they paid children to go to school. And an interesting thing is that these programs have actually been translated from the developing countries to the U.S. So you see in New York City, you see even in Champaign, where for perfect attendance, they were giving away a car last year, I think. Well, all those ideas come from things that were tested in the developing countries. So I think the thinking of people at the World Bank is a little bit more nuanced than neoliberalism. And I do think people need to be aware that a lot of economists do feel that these policies are failed. They don't support them anymore. But I still think, markets, price system, prices send very strong signals to farmers. They send very strong signals to consumers. And to some extent, we have to let that adjust. Some of these underlying things don't have, that doesn't have to do with neoliberalism. The growth in demand, demand for oil, that's all increasing the price. And I think we need to do what we can so people can respond to them.
I also want to make sure that we don't shift this to a defense of the World Bank mm-hmm. or IMF policies. The thing that caused these, that's a bigger discussion and cannot be done in an hour by any means or 5 minutes of response to a call. The food crisis last year, we already said, had a lot of causes, and you can debate how much these previous things fed into it. Ari mentioned a very different cause in terms of energy and alternative energy policies that have to be taken into account and weren't part of that particular neoliberal agricultural policy. Globalization, I think, has two aspects that lead to crises, global financial and economic crises, that are very important to think about as we look at what's going on with the food crisis and the current U.S. financial crisis. And that is, globalization has led to economies worldwide that are now more complex because of the different players involved in the meshing of different kind of policies and things like that, and also more tightly coupled than they were before. And these two aspects together play against each other in working out a lot of the different policy solutions, and they lead to more frequent and possibly deeper crises than before. So because I do believe in using intervention as well as relying on the market and having some kind of balance with those, I think it calls for us to prepare in advance to realize that there will be recurring crises connected to globalized markets, and that we can do things to make those crises shorter and less intense and less affecting people's lives, such as the programs that Mary just mentioned, like keeping kids in school. That's a very important part for girls and boys around the world. Mm-hmm.
Let me introduce again our guests for this hour of Focus 580. Gail Summerfield is Associate Professor of Human and Community Development here at the U of I. She's also Director of the Women and Gender in Global Perspectives Program. Mary Ahrens-Kenning is Associate Professor in the Department of Agricultural and Consumer Economics. She's also affiliated with the Center for Latin American and Caribbean Studies, the Center for South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies, and also with the program that Professor Summerfield directs, Women and Gender in Global Perspectives. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We're talking, at least in part, we started out trying to talk about the world food crisis that we saw much in the news earlier this year, and as part of a kind of informal series that we're doing here, trying to talk about international issues that figure in this year's presidential race here in the United States. And again, questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Next up is someone in Effingham. This is our toll-free line 4. Hello.
Yes, a question, and then I'd like a follow-up. The present condition of worldwide capitalism and its continuity as a paradigm occurs to me that it is worn out, and we continually, despite all the ramifications of something in its antithesis as being doable, and the subject matter of this program, and how people around the world are starving from in the third and fourth worlds, and then the World Bank and other entities like that come and say, here's the way you're going to survive, and they just go down deeper. And what would you say about that?
Well, I'll jump in first. It's related to what we were discussing before. But what I think you're raising to some degree is what kind of policies would be helpful in averting these in averting and relieving crises like the world food crisis. And I think that I mentioned before, and I want to stress again, we want some kind of inclusion of local markets and local farmers so that there's a combination of intervention and market behavior, in my opinion. When you just dump extra food on a country, it's very cheap, and so local farmers can't produce and compete with that. But when you buy their grain, it really helps them then plant again and continue the cycle. When people get unemployed, if you have some kind of work programs where they're getting an income, then they can buy the grain on their local market that they couldn't otherwise. So they're not just dependent on aid all the time. It helps re-stimulate things. When you have social safety nets so that in the long term, children are getting adequate nutrition in the first years of life and don't get mental damage, we have to pay attention to that. You can't feed the girls in the family and not the boys. So you've got to really consider these gender aspects and how you address them so that you support that basic ability to develop physically, mentally. Of a whole variety of other the education programs. People don't often link this directly to education, but if you do look at some of the materials coming out of the UN, the FAO, and some of these groups right now, IFAD, you will see that they are beginning to say that, food prices go up. The poor have to pull their kids out of school often. So it is linked, and we need policies included in that social safety net to address that. Property rights definitions can make a difference because if you're going to lose that land that you farm on, and farming is still a much larger component of GDP in a lot of developing countries, so you have to make sure that they really have the rights to that land and they don't lose them. They don't have to suddenly grow a non-food crop for some other kind of issue. So there's an array. It's a complex group of causes, and there's a complex set of policies that we can put into effect that really can make a difference.
But you haven't addressed the question of capitalism. It has failed. How can anybody not understand that capitalism, by buying and selling markets and profits and all that stuff, look where we're at today in this country with the highest accent of capitalism we live in, and it has failed, and people are not suffering yet like they're going to, with no jobs, high prices. Are we going to have food lines and all that here in the most capitalist advanced nation? I mean, please answer the question, is it working or is it not?
Well,
it is not working.
I would say, what are our alternatives? Maybe I could paraphrase and say capitalism is the worst economic system except all the other ones or something like that.
Well,
I'm not sure exactly what you mean about capitalism. I mean, would an alternative be socialism or what?
Well, it has to be done in the way that it is always done.
I'd like to intervene one thing and say that you're asking a really big question that there's more than one way for development. And it's, if people choose different paths, we're not about cutting them off and making them only take one route. The IMF and the World Bank are not the only policy set for development. You have different countries, different regional groups of agreement, and you have the potential for a whole variety of things around the world. So what we want to talk about today in this little period of time is not letting it slip that there is a global food crisis that is very basic to people, that's driving more people into poverty, and that regardless of what you support as a system or overall view, that there's actions that can be taken to relieve this and to realize that it's coming back again and that it's hovering in the background right now. A lot of people continue to suffer. They're just not out in the streets. The 800 million people who live in abject poverty were not necessarily the ones out in the street. Much more likely, according to many experts, were the 100 million that were being driven down there. So I appreciate this chance to at least bring this back into the media eye.
Let me jump in here, and we're getting into questions that are much larger than we can deal with in the scope of this program. Not that they aren't good questions, but not just for this program here today. Let me redirect a little bit and ask this question. Within the last few years, governments around the world and the United Nations have made commitments to very ambitious, a very ambitious level of international development, and laid out multi-point plans and set out a very, very big set of goals for what they would like to see happen within the next 10, 15 years, which, among other things, I think would involve by those countries a pretty significant outlay of money. It may mean changing policies within those countries, but it may also mean going out and spending money. We've already talked a little bit earlier about the fact that the amount of money the United States spends on all foreign aid all combined is really quite it's a very small part of the budget. And that even as you said last night, Senator Biden, when he was asked, well, what could you cut? That was the one thing that he mentioned. Well, we might have to cut that. I mean, how realistic is it to expect that that governments around the world would actually be able to back up the kind of commitments they – kind of rhetorical commitments they make to international development might actually be able to back that up with some real money?
A lot of the programs that help the poor are actually very inexpensive. Some of them are more expensive, but there are a lot of them that are relatively inexpensive, and we need to realize that. I mean, it's costly to allow poverty to persist and grow. It's costly politically as well as economically. And you get the growth of disruptions in societies based on that if you're just going to let other people flounder. So you can think of certain kind, like immunizations. They're cheap on the global scale. There's a number of the different kind of policies that could be applied in sub-Saharan Africa where you have actually the struggling of enough agriculture growth to support the people living there. And you have very rapid population growth, but you also have HIV/AIDS to deal with. Some of the programs that could be put into place to make parts of the components, like Jeffrey Sachs just wrote up a proposed three-pronged solution to some of this food crisis. And one of the things he was stressing was to try to improve conditions in Africa through making population planning devices more available at a very low cost per person globally, making immunizations and such things more available, and introducing these new kinds of food crops, putting more research and development into those. And in certain places, a lot of this work is relatively inexpensive. The overall picture is not going to be completely cheap, though. I agree with that.
That's true. And we know a lot more about what works and what doesn't. There's a group of economists who are doing a lot of social experiments. So, for example, with bed nets, those are nets that you put around your bed at night when you're sleeping to prevent mosquitoes, and they prevent malaria. So there are people, there are a lot of economists who are out there doing type of experiments to show how effective these are. And that's been great because then you have evidence on the table and say, well, this is very cost effective. This works well. So I'm in favor of doing more of those types of more of that type of research, and then funding any of these programs that seem like they work really well, that are implemented well. But I agree with Gail's point that some of these things are very cheap, and I also think it's in our national interest. It's not in our national interest to have countries poor and unstable. Besides the fact that you are a humanitarian aspect that you don't want to see people suffering, but even just a pure national interest, selfish interest, we benefit from other countries doing well. And
just to come back to a point that this is obviously is very politically sensitive, but I want to come back at least for a couple minutes here at the end to talk about U.S. farm policy. And not, I don't want to make it sound like we're saying foreign, no, far agricultural policy. Because there are some people who would argue that still that the policies that we have to support American farmers are part of the problem, and that they overweigh the kinds of things that we're doing on the development side. And I'm thinking about some of the discussions surrounding just the most recent iteration of the Farm Bill, where in the run-up to that, some people were saying, you know, this is really an opportunity. We have an opportunity to do things really differently than we have in the past, particularly when it came to agricultural subsidies. And there was a whole lot of talk, and when the bill actually came to be, it was pretty much like what we've been always doing. Is there any way that we can both protect the interests of American producers, but at the same time deal with the issue that American farm subsidies are not good for farmers in the developing world?
It's also very unfair because we say to the people in the developing world, our government says, do not have subsidies. Do not subsidize your farmers. Part of the neoliberal package of economic restructuring was do not continue to subsidize fertilizer and all these kind of farm applications. We also haven't really put, for 15 years at least, we have not put much emphasis on agricultural development. The idea was, the market would take care of it and people would move to the city and all these things would happen and somehow agriculture would just take care of itself. Well, I think we're seeing that that's not happening and that we have to look at global agricultural policies. And ours are part of that. Ours are a big part of that, and we are a big part of the research focus on that. One farmer at a recent workshop I was in said that if you're going to make a change like removing subsidies on ethanol, that do it when farmers are doing pretty well, and you won't get quite as much disagreement. So there's that issue that may come up. And in fact, we are seeing around the world a number of calls of slowing down. It's not saying cut out all biofuels, even in this first stage, but to slow down in promoting it and look at technological improvements. Look, there are low-cost alternatives. Look at that second generation. But with the second generation, also be aware that you may have expansion and take up more land. Look at trade policy. As we've discussed, you know, Brazil is producing a lot of this ethanol from sugarcane much more cheaply than the United States is from corn. Why won't we allow more trade there? They're going to be suing us about that one real soon, I believe. And I'm not saying that we have to do one or another of these things. I'm saying this is part of the array that we need to discuss.
Mm-hmm. Well, and do you see from the kinds of things that the two campaigns, the two major party campaigns have said that anybody's talking about doing anything particularly dramatically different?
Well, I believe McCain said in the last week when he did his presidential debate that he would eliminate all ethanol subsidies. And that seemed to me to be pretty dramatic change from current policy. I think in general, McCain is more in favor of free trade, but with provisions that our farmers stay protected, and Obama is more fair trade. So how that plays out for developing country farmers is pretty complicated. I think the thing that has the clearest implications is the policy for ethanol subsidies, where there seems to be more of a clear difference between the two candidates.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's related also to their base and who they're looking at in terms of who they have to immediately respond to, and also perhaps understanding the issues in more depth for the people that they deal with every day. And so I think the Obama group is reassessing what kind of biofuels policy they should be supporting, but they do definitely continue to say that would be part of the package, and they're looking at a whole lot of alternatives. And I agree with what you're saying about McCain. He's also promoting the offshore oil drilling. For some reason, nobody's talking about the fact that one reason they shut down the offshore oil drilling is they don't know how to stop the spills. And that is going to be a cost that should be included right now in the discussion of what the offshore oil drilling can supply to the country.
Well, just as a way of finishing up, maybe we have about a minute or so left, I guess I'm interested in coming back to the beginning, the point they made that these kinds of issues, well, they're maybe not on the top of the agenda right at the moment, not like they were earlier. We're still in a year from now, or maybe more than a year from now, we're still going to be talking about the same things. They're not going to go away.
Absolutely correct. They're not going away. They affect a huge proportion of the world's people directly. They affect those of us indirectly who may be better off so that we're not immediately running out of food. We may be making different choices. We may be, you know, driving less and doing a whole variety of different choices. But having those people hurt more reduces our welfare, too. We're in this together. And I think that we do have gender-specific policies that we can talk about and country-specific, but we have a global problem that we have to address.
Yeah. Right. I totally agree, too, and I would emphasize the need for more funding for agricultural research and the need to focus on the gender issues as well, so not to leave women out of the equation and to realize that how men and women are affected by this is different.
Well, at that point, I think we will stop. We would like to thank our two guests for this hour of Focus 580. Mary Ahrens-Kenning, she is Associate Professor in the Department of Agricultural and Consumer Economics, and Gail Summerfield, she is Associate Professor of Human and Community Development. She's also Director of Women and Gender in Global Perspectives program here on the U of I campus. This is the first of a number of shows we'll be doing over the next few weeks, and the suggestion was, well, let's try to get some discussion going about significant international issues that figure in this year's presidential contest. So we'll be doing a number of them. All of the guests will be here, folks here from the University of Illinois, and this has been the first. And thank you both very much for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.